Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Yvonne Zonderop. I'm honored to be the host of this evening, to be able to interview on stage the world famous Miss Yung Chang, who of course opened the eyes of the world to what actually happened in China during the reign of Mao, and in her devastating book Wild Swans. And we will perhaps be able to discuss some of that book, but mostly tonight we would like to speak about her newest book, about the three Sun Ling sisters. And she will tell you lots about it. She will give you a presentation on it. And afterwards, I will ask her some questions. And then, of course, there's always an opportunity for you to have questions for her. But before we start, I invite her on the podium and to tell about her new book and about how she came to write this one and her first book. I would like to know from you, from the audience, whom of you has read a book by Yung Chang? It seems like all have read a book of you. Did you read Wild Swans? Whom did? Yes. Oh, and some did also read other books, Mao perhaps, Mao book, or the book on Empress Dowager. She look at them, you have fans in the audience, Ms. Yung Chang. And I was wondering, who of you have heard of the Sun Ling sisters? Ah, oh, so many of you know about it. Well, then it will be an extra nice presentation for you, because she will go into details, very interesting details, on their lives and on the fate of China, which was so much integrated together. Please welcome Ms. Yung Chang.
Thank you. Hello. Thank you. I think before I get to the story of the three sisters, Song sisters, I'd just like to say a few words about how I became a writer. I loved writing when I was a child, but when I was growing up in China in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, it was impossible even to dream of becoming a writer. And in those years, in one after another of Mao's purges, nearly all writers were condemned, you know, sent to the gulag, driven to suicide, some were even executed. And even writing for oneself was dangerous. I remember writing my first poem on my 16th birthday in 1968. It was in the middle of the Cultural Revolution when books were burned across China, and all writing was dangerous. But I wrote my first poem, and I was lying in bed polishing my poem. And then I heard the door banging. The Red Guards had come to raid our flat. So if they got hold of my poem, I would have got into trouble, and my parents, my family, would get into trouble. So I quickly rushed to the bathroom to tear down my poem and flush it down the toilet. And that ended my first venture in writing. But the desire to write never left me. And in the following years, I was exiled to the edge of the Himalayas and worked as a peasant and as a barefoot doctor, and then later became a steel worker and an electrician. And when I was spreading manure in the paddy fields, and when I was checking electricity supplies on top of the electricity poles, I was always writing in my head with an imaginary pen, but I couldn't put pen to paper. Then in 1976, Mao died and China began to change. And in 1978, I became one of the first group of Chinese to come and study in the West. And I was so lucky, because I left China very early, that when I got my doctorate in linguistics in 1982, I became the first person from China, from communist China, to get a doctorate from a British university. And when I arrived in London, I could write. But then at that moment, the desire to write left me. because I had come to a completely different world, and everything was new. It was like landing on Mars. I just wanted to spend every minute having fun. I mean, when I first arrived, there were 14 of us in a group. We were all wearing the Mao suit, the blue uniform-like thing, and we had to walk, we had to move in a group. So we were quite a sight in the London streets. And there were many rules in those days, and the one thing was you mustn't go into an English pub, because the Chinese translation for pub is 酒吧, which suggested somewhere indecent with nude women dancing on the table. And so we were all told, don't go into a pub. And I knew there was a pub across the road from the college. And I was torn with curiosity, of course. So one day I sneaked out of the college. I darted across the road. I pushed the door of the pub open. And of course, I saw nothing of the kind, only some men sitting there drinking beer. I was rather disappointed, of course. So life was tremendously exciting, and I was the first to do so many things. And so to write would mean to me to look backward and inward into a past I wanted to forget all about. In the Cultural Revolution, my father died a tragic death. My beloved grandmother, who brought us up, also died. And I just didn't want to remember. I just didn't want to think about the past. So I didn't want to write. And then in 1988, 10 years after I came to Britain, my mother came to visit me. And for the first time, she told me the stories of her life and story of my grandmother and her relationship with my father. And once she started, my mother couldn't stop. She stayed with me for 6 months, and she talked every day. And by the time she left London, she had left me 60 hours of tape recordings. And when I was listening to my mother, I thought to myself, I've got to write all this down. And then it also seemed to me that my mother seemed to know that I had cherished this unspoken dream, and she was helping me to fulfill the dream, because when I was out working, she would talk into a tape recorder. And so after my mother left, I sat down and transcribed the tapes, and I started writing, and I wrote Wild Swans. And writing Wild Swans had turned me into a writer. My dream had been fulfilled. And then afterwards, I went on to write a biography of Mao, and then a biography of Empress Dowager Cixi. And Mao, we all know, you know, ruled China and for 27 years and dominated my early life. And the Empress Dowager was the first modernizer of China. She ruled China on and off for half a century, mainly on, and she was the person who brought China into the modern age. I first got interested in her because she was the first person to ban foot binding, the torture that had tortured China, made life hell for Chinese women for 1,000 years, and my grandmother's life was my grandmother's agony I saw when I was a child. And I wrote, then after the biography of Mao, I wrote biography of this great woman ruler of China. And she died in 1908, and before her death, she had committed to turn China into a constitutional monarchy with an elected parliament and a free press and so on, all of which she introduced. And then 40 years later, Mao seized the power and plunged the country into a totalitarian hell. What happened in those 40 years? What happened in those years that had begun with such hope and optimism and ended so abysmally? And then the stories of the three sisters, the Song sisters, and their husbands, Sun Yat-sen, who is called the father of China, still is called the father of China, of Republican China to be more precise, today, because he was the first person to advocate republicanism. And Chiang Kai-shek, Sun Yat-sen's successor and the ruler of China, nationalist China, for 22 years before Mao seized the power from him and drove him out of China to Taiwan. And their stories are the stories mainly of these 40 years, but then of course much longer, because little sister Mei Ling actually died this century in year 2003, aged 105. She saw three centuries. Now here is the story of the sisters in, let's say, 25 minutes. that's the three sisters, and this woman sitting in the middle is their mother. She came from the oldest Christian family in China. A district in Shanghai is still today named after her illustrious ancestor. And Ai Ling, big sister, standing on one side, Qing Ling, red sister, on the other. And this is their father, Chia Li Song. He had a very interesting experience. He went to America as a sort of coolie, unskilled worker in the late 19th century. But he ran away and ended up in the American South. And he became the first Chinese to be converted by the American Southern Methodists. And he stayed for 7 years in America, and he received a Methodist training, and he went back to China to be a preacher. And later he went into business and made a lot of money. With the money, what he most wanted to do was to give his children an American education, his three daughters as well as three sons. So big sister Ai Ling was sent to America in 1904, aged 14. She was the first Chinese woman to be educated in the West. And she was followed by red sister Qing Ling, aged 14, and little sister Mei Ling at the age of 9. And what's extraordinary to me is these girls were in America for years, completely on their own, without an adult member of the family to look after them. And little sister Mei Ling stayed in America for 10 years. And such was the faith of Charlie and his wife in American society and in the Methodist community. And red sister Qing Ling came back to China, and she fell in love with Sun Yat-sen, the father of Republican China, as we mentioned, and she wanted to marry him. But her parents were furiously against the marriage. And as you can see, Sun Yat-sen is a lot older than she, and more than twice her age. Moreover, he had a wife, three children, and a concubine, and many other women, and he was a womanizer. So Qing Ling's parents locked her up in her room, but she climbed out of the window and boarded a ship from Shanghai to Japan to marry him. She was madly in love, and she wanted to sacrifice herself for her husband and his cause. But she was furiously let down. In 1922, that year, the couple were surrounded by Sun Yat-sen's political enemies. And Qingling volunteered to stay behind to cover Sun Yat-sen's escape. So he fled. But what she didn't know is what when he got to safety, he still didn't want her to leave because he wanted her to stay there as a target to draw enemy fire, to make the fighting really big, so he could fight back from outside the city. And so, of course, she nearly died. She had a hellish escape of 2 days and two nights, and she suffered a miscarriage on the way, and she could never have children. And this was devastating to her, and her love for her husband died. But she didn't want to divorce him. She thought about it, and she decided she wanted to do deals with him. And the deal she wanted was to become his political partner and a politician in her own right. And here you can see she is standing on stage, and this is the opening of the Wangpo Military Academy in Canton, and Sun Yat-sen is standing behind the desk. To fulfill his dream, Sun Yat-sen's dream, which was actually to become the president of Republican China, he brought in Soviet Russians to help him overthrow the Beijing government, which was actually democratically elected and internationally recognized. And the Russians supplied him with arms, with advisors, lots of money, and built this military academy for him. And to his right is Chiang Kai-shek, Sun Yat-sen's successor after Sun died in 1925. Chiang Kai-shek was the head of the academy and the head of Sun Yat-sen's army, the army that overthrew the Beijing government. Now, Chiang Kai-shek was passionately anti-communist. So after Sun Yat-sen died in 1925, he maneuvered and split in 1927 from Moscow and from the Chinese communists. And the Song sisters were also split into two political camps. This is the last really happy picture of the three of them together just before the split. And Red Sister Qingling in the dark Cheongsan is the Red Sister. She had been converted by the Soviets to be a Leninist in the 1920s. And she went with the communists. And the big sister Eiling sitting there, little sister Meiling standing, were anti-communists. And they went with Chiang Kai-shek. Now, little sister Meiling then married Chiang Kai-shek. This is their wedding in Shanghai. And this is the couple on their honeymoon. But little sister's marriage went through many ups and downs. She, in fact, sank into a depression for nearly 7 years soon after her marriage. And this was because she wasn't prepared for the kind of life with Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek had started his political career as an assassin. He had bumped off a political rival of Sun Yat-sen's, which was how he caught Sun Yat-sen's eye and was made his successor. And as a result, he himself was pursued by assassins from all directions, and some got into their bedroom and went near their bed. And as a result, little sister also suffered a miscarriage and could never have children. And Chiang Kai-shek loved his wife and was desperate to pull her out of depression. In 1932, he gave her a present, a necklace, but it was no ordinary necklace. as you can see, it encircled a whole mountain outside Nanjing. The jewel of the necklace in the middle is a gorgeous villa. It's called the Mei Ling Palace, and it has green tiles on the roof, which sparkle in the sun, looking like a real jewel. The chains are French pine trees, which Chiang Kai-shek had imported. And these foreign trees color in autumn in a different way from local Chinese trees, you know, forming a distinct necklace. So he has some imagination. So all people who want to give their the companions necklaces could take this as a as an example. Big sister Eileen introduced the couple, and she was the person who had most influence on Chiang Kai-shek. And as a result, she made herself one of the richest women in China. And she and her husband, H.H. Kong, whom, thanks to her, became Chiang Kai-shek's prime minister and finance minister for well over a decade. Meanwhile, Red Sister Qing Ling went into exile in Russia. Here she is in the Caucasus. And the man to her left is somebody called the Deng Yanda, who was a very charismatic man with leadership qualities. In fact, Stalin, he also went into exile in Russia. Stalin thought so highly of him. And Stalin, after meeting him for 6 hours, more than 6 hours, yes, in the Kremlin, Stalin proposed to make him the head of the Chinese Communist Party. But he said he didn't even believe in communism. So having turned down Stalin, his life was in danger. So he fled to Berlin. And Red Sister Qing Ling followed him there. And they fell in love. And she was really madly in love with him. He wanted to form a third party, different from the communists and the nationalists. And he went back to China to organize the party. And he became the biggest threat to Chiang Kai-shek. So Chiang Kai-shek had him murdered in 1931. And of course, Red Sister Qing Ling hated Chiang Kai-shek now for personal reasons as well as political reasons. And she devoted the rest of her life to help Mao beat Chiang and by supporting Mao. The war against Japan in 1937 brought the sisters back briefly together, and little sister Mei Ling was the first lady of wartime China. Here she is visiting wounded soldiers. And she visited America in 1943 in a triumphant tour. Here she is addressing Congress, and the standing ovation lasted 4 minutes. And she is at Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles, where the welcoming crowd was 30,000. And she is sitting there with a bouquet on her lap. And to her right is her nephew, David. Now, of the three sisters, only big sister Eileen was able to have children. So she had 4 children, 2 boys and 2 girls. And she basically gave 2 of them, a boy and a girl, to little sister Mei Ling. So they grew up closer to Mei Ling than to their real mother. And David was traveling with her. On the other side is her niece, Jeanette. Jeanette was gay. And unusual for her time, she didn't try to cover the fact. And on the contrary, she flaunted it by always wearing men's clothes and men's haircut. In America, President Roosevelt called her my boy. And the Chiang Kai-shek's at a Cairo conference with President Roosevelt and the Prime Minister Churchill. And they were together, the three sisters were together in Chongqing, China's wartime capital. And you can see that red sister, Qingling, she always made sure that she stood away from them and she never smiled in the presence of Chiang Kai-shek. Oh, their brothers and their wives will skip them. Yes. Okay, so, let me have a drink.
Yeah, have a drink. A
sip of water. Now, this is Chiang Kai-shek's portrait on Tiananmen Gate, very near where Mao's portrait is today. And this was just after the war, after victory against Japan. But a civil war soon started, and Mao beat Chiang Kai-shek in 1949. This is Chiang Kai-shek leaving his ancestral home to flee to Taiwan. And the man standing, you know, in the middle looking downcast. And the man with a hat on to Chiang Kai-shek's right is his son, Qin Guo, Chiang's only blood son and only heir. And Qin Guo was kept hostage in Russia by Stalin for 12 years. And Chiang Kai-shek was desperate to get his son back because Qin Guo was thrown into a gulag and you know, could be killed by Stalin any time. So Chiang Kai-shek then offered Stalin a deal, a trade-off, to trade the survival of the Chinese communists and the Red Army for the return of his son. So at a time when Chiang Kai-shek could have wiped out the Red Army, particularly on the Long March in the mid-1930s, he let them go. And as a result, his son was returned in 1937. And of course, he himself lost China. And after Chiang Kai-shek died in Taiwan in 1975, Qin Guo succeeded his father to be the ruler of Taiwan. It was he who started, who put Taiwan on the road to democracy, which it is today. Okay, we'll skip this. And Red Sister Qingling, the short woman on Tiananmen Gate with Mao on this side and the Prime Minister Zhou Enlai to her right. And next to Zhou Enlai is Deng Xiaoping, the post-Mao paramount leader, because she rose to be Mao's vice chair. And here she is in the lineup of the leaders, the shortest woman supported by a member of staff, and with these gaps. And these gaps were Mao's wife and the Gang of Four, you know, Mao's assistants, but on Tiananmen Gate. And, sorry, when the Gang of Four, and after the Gang of Four was at the Mao's memorial service, they were soon arrested. In fact, when the picture was taken, they were still there, the four people. And when the by the time the picture was published, they had gone to jail. So the editor had just to remove them physically from the picture, and leaving these conspicuous gaps. You may ask what Elvis is doing here with the sisters. Well, actually, the lady he was holding is called Deborah Paget, who's the leading lady of Elvis's first film, Love Me Tender. Actually, she was a star. She had to promote him because it was his first film. And Elvis proposed to Deborah, but Deborah turned down the king to marry Ai Ling's son. And here is me. I'm wearing the same clothes. It's me, actually, with Deborah. This is a few years ago when I was doing research. I was in Texas and interviewed them with Deborah and Deborah's son, Gregory. Greg is the only descendant of the three sisters, of the three illustrious sisters. Little sister Maiden, as I said, you know, died aged 105 in 2003 in New York. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
Please sit down.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
What an unbelievable story this is, actually, isn't it? Mm. It's these women, these three sisters, they were at the heart of the Chinese history at the time, and not just being part of it, but also making part of it. Mm. Were you aware of their role when you started to think about this book?
Their role. I wasn't very clear about their exact role. I knew, you know, there were fairy tale stories. I mean, everybody in China knows about them. But exactly what they are, and people don't actually have very clear ideas. And there is this cliche that once upon a time, there were three sisters in China, and one loves money, one loves power, one loves the people. Of course, as you can see, this is the communist cliche. But most people don't have a very clear idea, and I myself didn't have very clear idea about them. And it was through the research that I learned so much about them.
And why did you decide to write about them?
Well, the thing is, I wasn't interested in them. I just, before, I knew very little, and I thought they were rich, they married to powerful men, and they led a very privileged life, and I didn't see any human side of them. So actually, I wanted to write a biography of Sun Yat-sen. And because I had written the biography of Mao, and I had written the biography of Empress Dowager Cixi, and Sun Yat-sen is the most important man who made China go in the direction from Mao to Cixi. So I wanted to write about him. And I did a lot of research. I got a lot of things. And then I got a little fed up with him because he was like a mini Mao, and all he wanted is power. I mean, he is known throughout the Chinese-speaking world as a saint, as though he was his famous saying, "天下为公," everything under heaven is for the people. In fact, nothing is for the people as far as he was concerned. And he was only thinking of becoming the president of China, which he couldn't be, because I'm very glad to say that I discovered this. China was actually a functioning democracy. After the Republic was founded in 1912, to Chiang Kai-shek overthrowing the Beijing government in 1928, within those 16 years, China had elections every 5 years, had a functioning parliament, reasonably independent, you know, legal system that was going towards independent, and free press, complete free press. Speech, freedom of speech, why did I get there? Sun Yat-sen didn't. He made the decision not to participate in elections because he knew he would not be elected. He was a dictator, and he had this reputation even before the Republican Revolution. He wanted to give orders and wanted to be obeyed. By working with the temporary parliament, mm-hmm. he already came to the conclusion that it was not for him, because no. he wanted people just to take orders. He didn't want to discuss, didn't want to share power.
And you didn't really want to write a biography about him.
I didn't. Then I decided
you disliked him. I disliked him.
And then, you know, I've written about Mao, who was power hungry, and I don't want to write another megalomaniac.
No.
Power hungry. And okay.
And that's when you decided let's focus on
The sisters. Then I realized actually Sun Yat-sen's wife and her sisters were much more interesting, and you know, their personal lives, their characters, their loves, their heartbreaks, their betrayals. I mean, what betrayal to each other? I mean, Red Sister Qing Ling devoting her entire life to ruin her family and her two sisters, whilst pretending to be very pally with them.
Yes.
But, you know, just the tension between the three sisters must be unbearable. And all this, I found them very interesting, how they dealt with these tensions.
Yes, and they are obviously very intelligent and strong women.
Strong women, yes. And also, I found this relationship between little sister Mei Ling and Chiang Kai-shek very, very interesting. Because little sister Mei Ling actually wanted to leave Chiang Kai-shek many times. And when Chiang Kai-shek fled mainland China, as we saw in the picture, she wasn't with him. She was in New York. Actually, she wanted never to return to China and to live with Chiang Kai-shek. So Chiang Kai-shek flew to Taiwan. She didn't want to go to Taiwan. And then she sort of she was torn with agony because, you know, her husband was thrown there. This was before the Korean War started in June 1950, and at the time America hadn't committed to defend Taiwan. You know, Taiwan, and who's surviving because, not surviving, who's thriving as a democracy, but also its survival is dependent on American support. And America at that point wanted to have nothing to do with Chiang Kai-shek's regime. So Taiwan was really in danger. Mao had asked Stalin for help to attack Taiwan, and Stalin had agreed. So Taiwan was really in danger. And then Mei Ling then decided, after much agony, I won't go into the detail, praying to God and so on, he felt he had God guidance, which was she should go and stand with her husband for Taiwan. And she went to Taiwan at the beginning of 1950. And from then on, whenever Taiwan was in trouble, meaning Mao was prepared to, was gearing up to attack Taiwan, and she would fly to Taiwan. But when Taiwan was okay, she would go back to New York to live the life she really wanted. So that was also quite interesting.
Very.
Yeah.
How difficult was it for you to obtain your information?
Actually, writing this book is the easiest, because a lot of the work research had been done before. I mean, their lives overlap with Mao's life, mm-hmm. And with the Empress Dowager's life. Mm-hmm. So a lot of research had been done. I'll tell you the importance of Red Sister Qing Ling. I ought to have it in the PowerPoint, actually. There is a picture of the national, the Kuomintang leadership after her husband's death. And she was sitting in the middle, on the front row. And Mao was standing behind her, you know, some way, you know, to the side. So she was really kind of important. She had a higher position than Mao.
Yes.
Okay, back to research. So that was that research. And also, because the sisters were educated in America, their archives are in America. And Chiang Kai-shek's diaries, you know, Chiang Kai-shek kept a diary for 57 years. And every day, and the diaries were surprisingly personal about his relationship with his wife and so on. So that's in America at the Hoover Institute. And now, but most of the research had been done when I was writing the biography of Mao, mm-hmm. which took me and my husband, John Halliday, 12 years to research and write. Well, actually, we had great fun. We divided our research by language. Because I am Chinese, so I dealt with the Chinese language sources. And John, unfortunately, speaks many languages, so he was landed with the rest of the world. And particularly, he speaks Russian and spent years working in the Russian archives, which turned out to be a treasure trove. And we traveled all over the world and interviewed everyone who had interesting dealings with Mao. Presidents, you know, sort of national security advisors, CIA chiefs, and so on. And in China, we were very lucky. It was the 1990s, and the eyewitnesses were still alive, so we interviewed. And we also traveled around the world. Do you know this woman, Imelda Marcos? Yes, I think a lot of you know, yeah. She was, and we interviewed her because she saw Mao. She had very interesting dealings with Mao, and I was in China then, and in those days there were no films, yeah, we couldn't see anything. We could only see some newsreels, and my abiding memory was this newsreel when Imelda Marcos met Mao. She looked glorious. She had this national dress of the Philippines, and Mao, who was also a womanizer, was nearly in tears, and Mao picked her hand up and kissed her hand. I remember being astonished at the time because this gesture of gallantry would have landed anyone else to a denunciation meeting and being condemned as practicing bourgeois habit. And here was Mao doing this. Anyway, now, Madame Mao also saw this and became very jealous because Madame Mao could also only, like us, only wear like a Mao uniform, very unbecoming. So she saw Imelda looking so glorious, and so she wanted to design a national dress for Chinese women. But her dress was so unbecoming, and even us, you know, fashion starved women, whatever, scorned it with universal scorn. But still, the ban, I remember that year, 1975, was lifted on women wearing dress. So as an adult, I wore my first dress in 1975. So Imelda's contribution to some pleasures in our life. But when John and I saw her, she batted her eyes furiously at John, my John, and then she turned to me and said, "Western men simply don't understand us Eastern women." And John said, "Have you come across any Western men who understand you?" She said, "Only one person, Richard Nixon." And it was very, so we had such fun. And I must just tell you this one fun, incredible story to me, which was we were in Hong Kong having done 2 months research in China in the 1990s. And John was in the bathroom of our hotel room, and he shouted, "Guess who's in this hotel? Sorry, this Zaireing Mobutu, this tyrant of Zaire, now Congo." And John said, "Shall we try to find somebody to introduce us?" And I said, "John, I can't be bothered. I've done 2 months interviews. I'm going to the hair salon." So I went to the hair salon, and 10 minutes later, who but Mobutu strutted in. And he was sitting, you know, like where you are, and he was under this hair thing. he had bits of cotton wool around his head, a bit of towels around his neck, and he was trapped. And so when I was led to have my hair rinsed, I was able to pause in front of him and got our interview. So we had
that's
great
wonderful
fun.
Yes, a lot of fun. And what you told us earlier about you actually discovering the period of democracy in China between 1912 or say the
1928.
That was a discovery you made at the time, or did you make it for this book?
For this book.
Yes.
Because
and how did you find it?
Well, that period is the most vague period. I mean, nobody knows what's happening. And so people just said it's warlords fighting. So, but since I was writing this book, I need to, in fact, the question even appeared to me when I was writing Wild Swans. Did China actually have a government in Beijing? And where is the government? And that was when I was writing Wild Swans. And then this question grew bigger and bigger. And then I did a lot of research on this period, and I realized that there was an election. There were three elections, once every 5 years, 1913, 1918, and 1923. And there was a functioning parliament with all their names, you know, their bills they passed, and so on. And the details I'll leave you to read in the book.
Yes.
But it qualifies for a democracy, a complete press freedom. And the thing is, and when Chiang Kai-shek seized the power, he, of course, to justify his power, he condemned that period as warlord fighting, as though he and Sun Yat-sen had brought national unity. In fact, the nation was united. There were sporadic fightings, but nobody wanted to overturn the democracy. Everybody wanted to return, after brief fighting, everybody wanted to return to the parliament, to elections. And Chiang Kai-shek and before him Sun Yat-sen were the actual people who created the most wars, most fighting.
And who killed the beginning democracy.
Killed the beginning of democracy, yes.
And of course you get the idea that perhaps democracy could still flourish in China?
I think it is, yes, well, I mean, studying that period astonished me to see how easily the Chinese adjusted to democracy. I don't want to go into the details, but the country made the transfer to democracy from monarchy to democracy astonishingly easily. In fact, so easily that in history books, you study this period called the Qingmo Mingchu. Qingmo, the end of the Manchu dynasty, Mingchu, the beginning of the republic. They are a coherent historical period. And this was because both periods share the same goal, to turn China into a democracy. And the people responded to it. I mean, there was the country was in seeming chaos. This was because it had a free press. With a free press, you always see problems, rows in the parliament, provinces disagreeing with this bill, that bill. And it's the time when you see no chaos from the government. Then you know the government is in trouble, it's actually a dictatorship. But I feel now, having said all this, as I think 100 years later, it's actually more difficult for China to become a democracy. I feel that because 100 of dictatorship, communist rule, and before communist, Chiang Kai-shek's rule, and Chiang Kai-shek was taught by the same teacher. The Nationalist Party was also taught by the Russians. I lost my voice 2 months ago.
Well, she's doing still very well, of course, speaking up to us of this. You speak, it's more difficult now in China, perhaps, to see democracy than 100 years ago, and the reasons you give is all these men who were actually fighting for power, and then as soon as they had power, their main goal was keep the power. That was what they were for, much more important than actually taking care of this, of the civilians. Rewriting about the sisters, was it for you also perhaps a way of setting the record straight and say it's not just about men, but also about women?
Well, I do find writing about women, my voice is very much more interesting.
Is it becoming too difficult?
It's.
Oh, wait a minute.
Sorry.
Have another sip of water,
no,
please.
No, okay. You talk.
Yes, I talk.
Well, maybe people.
Let her get her voice back a bit, perhaps. So perhaps she can. Have some more answers to questions of yours, but I don't know, not all of you have read the book, but one of the things I found very interesting in the book, and perhaps that's also something you maybe later be able to give some remarks on, is how important these women are, and how important also their emotions and their personal lives interfered with the political outcomes of things. Of course, the example of Chiang Kai-shek, who traded China for his own son, who was held hostage by Stalin, but also some of the like Mei Ling or Qing Ling, who would fight Chiang Kai-shek because he had her big love killed. So I was raised with the idea that politics is about ideas. But if you read your book, you get this distinct impression politics is also very much about deep felt emotions. And that's something you show in the book. And is that something you wanted to show in the book also?
Yes, I always think I dislike dry history books or politics books. I think actually, ultimately, there is always the human dimension. History is made by human beings, politics practiced by human beings, and so human emotions are very, very relevant in the policies and in the practice and in history.
Very good, very good. Because Ms. Chang's voice is obviously not completely well, let's just see if there are some questions in the audience. I'll give you some time for questions, and then we will not give long time because so you can keep silent for longer. I saw somebody standing there. Could you please state your name and your question, of course.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Scott. Shushin, wo sheng shuo shishi nin lai zhili. Wo jie de ni tai bang le. So, two questions, but they're kind of related. First one's about economics. I think it was Bill Clinton in 94. He was at a press conference, and he kind of put down this theory that the West has kind of took on, which is if only we trade with China, they'll become democratic once again. That's turned out not to be true. What do you think we as Westerners got wrong, is the first question. And secondly, when I lived in China, I found it quite difficult to find people to actually talk about the Cultural Revolution with. That's when I read your book, and then I saw a movie called Ba Wang Bie Ji. It's one of my favorites, Farewell My Concubine. My question to you is, that movie in particular, I don't know if you've seen it, but how accurate is it to what actually happened during that time?
Can you answer?
The Farewell My Concubine, how accurate is that? Yeah. I can't remember the film. Now, I saw it many years ago, 30 years ago, I think. So I can't comment on that. About whether the West had got it wrong that economic prosperity would lead to democracy. You see, I don't think we've come to the end yet. We don't know. I mean, at the moment, there is definitely a setback, and Mr. Xi and maybe a few others, did want to turn, wind back the clock and made China go back to more strictly communist than Mao's time. But things are still evolving. I mean, things are still in development. So I wouldn't like to say, where did we get wrong? We don't know whether the West is wrong. I mean, we have to see. And I would say at the moment there is definitely a setback. But I would also say that, I mean, really, I see there are some Chinese faces here, so you can correct me. I see, but from what I know, there is a yearning among the people to have some say, to make that, you know, to be democracy, to be some form of democracy. And so I don't think we're wrong yet, and we have yet to see how things evolve.
Thank you. Thank you. There was some question over there in the end, at the back.
My name is Willem Olvermeer. I'm a Dutch journalist. I spent some time in China as well, but some time ago, actually. I understand that in 2012, Xi Jinping actually referred to the period of the warlords. He mentioned it as an example of trial and error for democracy. He said, we tried any possible system that's in the history of mankind, and communism came out as the best.
Hmm. He would say that, wouldn't he? Well, the thing is, I obviously disagree because I'm a writer. I think you're a journalist, and I think freedom of speech is important to us. And as you can see from the latest outbursts of the virus, the coronavirus, how freedom of speech is important to everybody, how the killing of freedom of speech can lead to this absolute catastrophe for China, for the world. This is just the, you know, you can't find a better example to show the importance of freedom of speech, to show the absolute horror and unacceptability of suppression of the freedom of speech. that period failed because of Soviet Russia. Without Soviet Russia, Sun Yat-sen would not have been able to build his army. We saw the Wang Po Military Academy and the money the Russians supplied him, the arms they supplied him. They did everything to subvert the Beijing government and put Sun Yat-sen in power. Then Chiang Kai-shek defeated Sun Yat-sen, defeated the Beijing government because he had this Soviet-built military machine. So I think if China were to be another democracy and these lessons would be drawn, could be drawn, and I think we'll definitely go a different way. To take some, you know, precautions, and this is the kind of thing lessons people draw from history. But it doesn't mean democracy is unworkable. Democracy was workable and did work in China. And that period, by the way, the 1920s, economically is now referred to by specialists as the golden years, the golden period. That period, the Chinese economy was doing very well. And also all the giants in literature, in language, in music, in the arts, they all came from that period. And this flourishing of artistic and literary scene is attributed to the May 4th movement, this student demonstration in 1919. In fact, before writing this book, I always had the question, what does this demonstration have to do with the great flourishment of culture? And now I realize nothing, I mean, through my research of this book, it's nothing to do with the May the 4th movement. If there is anything that linked them, is they were both possible. A demonstration was possible in under democratic government. The artistic freedom was possible because China was a democracy. And this, no, there is no cause-effect relationship between the two. But of course, the myth is created by those in power and the belief in dictatorship, first by Chiang Kai-shek's government, then by Mao's government.
I saw one more question. Right. Over there. Yeah, oh, two even. Okay. Can you still have two questions? Okay.
Thank you. My name is Arnat. I've lost my voice as well. I love your books, and I like to read, but I've also read a great book about the Song dynasty, the Song family, called the Song Dynasty, by a guy called Seagrave. And in his book, his argument was not only were the Russians a major influence in the power politics at that time, but for Sun Yat-sen and Chiang Kai-shek, the triads, the Chinese gangsters, were very important as well, especially from Shanghai. I think they were called the Green Gang, led by a man called Big Ears. I can't remember. Mm. Did you discover that? I was quite shocked by that. And did you discover that in your investigations? And do you agree with that they had a big influence on the Kuomintang?
Okay. Now, that book you refer to, the Song Dynasty, was published in 1985. That was before the Gorbachev's revolution, before Soviet archives were opened by under Yeltsin. And once the Soviet archives are opened, the entire history of communist movement and the world has to be rewritten, because there is a rushing hand in everything, in every country, in every revolution. So the gangsters were important in the sense that Sun Yat-sen's revolution was through gangsters. And the Republican Revolution under Sun Yat-sen started with him collecting, you know, raising money to pay these gangsters to have uprisings or riots to try to overthrow the Beijing government. Actually, they didn't succeed. Eventually, the revolution of 1911 took place not by gangsters, but by mutiny, but by, you know, Republican-minded army soldiers. And Sun Yat-sen was not leading that revolution. He was abroad. In fact, the Republicans scorned him and said he was always far away when there was a fighting. He was a coward and so on. Anyway, but he also had to preserve himself, and he wanted to come, didn't want to come back to China to have his neck chopped, his head chopped off. But the gangsters, not at all the reason, but I don't even follow the logic why the gangsters should make such a difference. They were important because they provided the soldiers for Sun Yat-sen. And Chiang Kai-shek had this gangster background. He followed not Big Year Du. Big Year Du came later. I mean, people always got mixed up. The real gangster godfather was Chen Qimei. He took Shanghai during the Republican Revolution and made sure that Sun Yat-sen was elected the interim president at the beginning. And it was important. The gangster controlled Sun Yat-sen's territory, and the gangsters did all sorts of things for Sun Yat-sen, including assassinating his political rivals, where Chiang Kai-shek came in. Chiang Kai-shek basically was a gangster himself. He bumped off this main rival of Sun Yat-sen's and became Sun's successor.
It's all in the book, I can tell you. So there's one person there, and then I'll ask if you still have...
Fine.
Thank you very much for a very interesting talk. I want to ask some more about the period between 1911-12 to the founding of the Republic of China. As I understood, in about 1912, the Yuan Shikai was in charge in China, and he was actually, after the Qing dynasty fell, he was in the process of starting his own dynasty. So how does that fit in the...
Who's he?
Yuan Shikai.
Oh, Yuan Shikai, yes. Yuan Shikai. Okay.
How does he fit into the democracy?
Okay.
Like you talked about.
Yes, I don't know. We're getting very detailed, but I'm very, very pleased that you're interested.
We can all see, and it's also
it's very informed the audience because in London, yeah. Quite frankly, I don't know nearly half the people who knew about Sun Yat-sen among my friends. I don't think anyone knew Sun Yat-sen, heard of him. Okay. Anyway, so I'm very, very pleased. Now, what happened was when the Republican Revolution started. This was before Sun Yat-sen returned to China. And, you're talking about Yuan Shikai. The Republicans, the Qing court started talking to the Republicans to have a peace talk, in order to avoid bloodshed. And they agreed that if Yuan Shikai, who was then the prime minister of the Qing dynasty, if Yuan Shikai would persuade the Qing court, the Manchu court, to surrender power so they could have a peaceful Republican revolution, the Republicans would vote for him to become the first president of Republican China. So they agreed. Now, when Sun Yat-sen came back, Sun was the first person to promote republicanism. He wanted to be the first president. But the delegates, now there are these delegates from all the provinces which had mutinies and uprisings. The delegates formed a temporary parliament, and they said to Sun Yat-sen, no. You can't be, because we have this agreement with the court that if it's peaceful, and Yuan Shikai should be the first interim president, the formal president had to be elected. And so it was under this understanding that Sun Yat-sen was made a interim president. But when he swore in, he had to say that once peace is reached and I will surrender my post to Yuan Shikai, which is why he was an interim president for only 40 days. And in this 40 days later, Yuan Shikai had persuaded the Qing court to surrender power. So he was voted by this interim parliament, the delegates from the provinces, to be the interim president. This is 1912. In 1913, the general election was held throughout China, in all China's 22 provinces. And a parliament was elected. Actually, the nationalists formed a majority of the parliament. And the parliament then elected Yuan Shikai. Yuan Shikai was the first elected president of China in 1913. There are now books, documents, really solid documents about the election process, and not to mention memoirs. The documents are monumental of this period of how Yuan Shikai was elected. So he was elected, and Sun Yat-sen decided, this is when Sun Yat-sen decided that democracy was not for him, because the parliament would not elect him. They elected Yuan Shikai. This was why he actually was the person who invented the saying, power comes from the barrel of the gun. He went for the gun route. Now, for those who knew Yuan Shikai, you may remember Yuan Shikai then wanted to make himself the emperor. This was a kind of a could have been a setback, but it was not, because he never made himself the emperor. The public opinion by 1915 was overwhelming. All the press started to attack him, and all his buddies, his closest and nearest, not to mention the whole government, revolted against him. And he had to announce that he abandoned the wish to return China to monarchy. And so China was, a quite functioning democracy. This is another proof. He actually never made himself an emperor. And this is a complete myth that's still perpetrated in China and other Chinese-speaking world that he made himself an emperor. He didn't. He was defeated by a democratic China at the time. And China continued. He soon died, and he's, according to the constitution, the deputy vice president steps in, and the vice president stepped in, and as the next president, of course, Sun Yat-sen found another excuse to start a war against the next president, and then after the general election in 1918, and a new president, Xu Shichang, was elected, and Sun Yat-sen found another excuse to launch a war. He was the person who was always launching wars in this period of so-called warlord fighting, and he was not counted as a warlord, even though he had the army, he had the base in Canton. But the thing is, I think I've answered your question about Yuan Shikai.
I think so too, and I also think that perhaps
by the way, if you're students of Chinese history, this period is, I highly, highly recommend you to study this period, because there is enough documents. Because then it was a democracy, there are mountains of documents waiting for some researcher to go and work on them, how this republic functioned. That's absolutely riveting, and nobody has studied it. I mean, nobody is saying, except me, I'm doing it here, nobody is saying that how China was functioning as a democracy and why it changed. Just absolutely riveting virgin ground for really ambitious and dedicated historians, his students of history to study. And there are documents, and also all these foreign press, New York Times. I got a lot of things from New York Times archives. Their reports, I'm sure there are Dutch papers reporting the period. Lots of reports in the U.S. archives. You go to Washington National Archives. There are these reports from the embassies, U.S. embassies, people who met Yuan Shikai, people who met Sun Yat-sen, people who met this warlord, that warlord. They're all there, waiting for people to read, but very few people had gone to read those for 100 years. Imagine your joy suddenly to have all this to yourself.
Well, need you say more? Let me give one person the last question, and then I think we'll give you some space for your voice again. I think you wanted to ask a question.
Thank you very, very, very much for your inspiration you gave us tonight. And I feel a little bit guilty for putting another question when I realized that you suffer from your voice. But still, it's for me a burning question. Mm-hmm. Could you give us some... the opinions we have about the current people in power in China is a little bit too simple, too traditional. There are bad people and that's it. And I think you could give us some quotes which help us to see them with two eyes.
But to comment on whether Western opinions of Chinese government is too simple.
Could you give us some insider quotes about them?
About the current
leaders of China.
Yes. Well, the thing is this, unfortunately, because of my books, which are all banned in mainland China, and I can't go back to China except for 2 weeks a year to see my mother. This was a privilege which was given to me through the help of British government. And so I don't have the access to the kind of to the inner workings of the regime, and I don't have access to the archive documents. So basically, I have to say I don't know. I'm sorry to disappoint you. I really don't know. I mean, I because I work from documents, and from those, I know how different the truth is often from what it seemed to be. So I apart from my views, which I think you know, I've just said it, I really don't know. I mean, you need somebody who knows the inner workings of the government to really help you understand. Okay, I'm terribly sorry. Yes, but that's, yes.
Well, and let me put that, especially this book, I've read more of your books, but especially this book makes it so clear how important persons and are. Persons are in politics, and even if you agree or don't agree, also these personal aspects are so important. So you start, as a reader, you start to understand the politics so much better because of the very good way you write your books, and I think that is the best ending to tonight's discussion. I will invite Ms. Yung Chang to go outside with me and be able to sign the books if you want to buy a book and have it signed by Ms. Yung Chang. And thank you for her work and for your attention. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.